Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now, and we're following riveting testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee today by Christine Blasey Ford, who says that Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh held her down and sexually assaulted her at a social gathering in high school in the 1980s while she was locked in a room with Kavanaugh and his friend, Mark Judge.
Both Brett and Mark were drunkenly laughing during the attack. They seemed to be having a very good time. Mark seemed ambivalent, at times urging Brett on, and at times telling him to stop. A couple of times I made eye contact with Mark and thought he might try to help me, but he did not.
Brett Kavanaugh denies these accusations, and he's going to testify later today. NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro is here. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there, Robin.
Boy, she started by saying she was terrified, but yeah. She felt it was her civic duty, then told this story about being pushed into a bedroom from behind, and suddenly she says Brett Kavanaugh was on top of her. What's your sense of what you're hearing?
Well, very hard not to have a deep level of empathy for her. This is, clearly is a very difficult thing for her to do. This is not somebody who is used to the spotlight. You know, she has seemed to grow more comfortable as the day has grown along. And but at the very beginning, as you noted, she said that she was terrified. And she's come across, though, as an exceedingly normal person with no real reason for why she would be making any of this up, as the president and others have intimated as possible.
Now, we just came back from a lunch break. Republican senators emerging from the committee room at that time. It's reported that they've said she is believable. So what does that mean?
Well, I think that a lot of Republicans know that they've put themselves in a little bit of a box here. How are they going to be able to, you know, quote unquote, treat her respectfully as they had been talking about before this, and then still hope to vote on Judge Kavanaugh's nomination and get him through
tomorrow
to the Supreme Court? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it certainly seems like tomorrow would be an exceedingly quick way to go about it, especially considering that we have not heard from Brett Kavanaugh. He's scheduled to speak after Christine Blasey Ford does today. And, you know, without without other witnesses here to say, you know, to even back up, you know, Kavanaugh at this point, it seems really difficult that Republicans would want to vote tomorrow. You know, they seem like they would need to get together and figure out with the president as well whether they want this nomination to proceed.
Well, not all Republicans are nervous. We're going to hear from one in just a second. But, well, let's do that. Let's listen to Senator Lindsey Graham, who spoke with reporters in the hallway during a lunch break.
They've tried to destroy this guy's life, one accusation after another, that he's a serial rapist. That some woman said, I went to 10 parties where they're drug and raping people. I don't believe that one bit.
Yeah, but, you know, you've got, coupled with what's going on in this hearing room, the New York Times today with stories from his former roommate saying that, you know, he was unusually drunk and could get mean-spirited.
And we should fact check a little bit what Lindsey Graham is saying there, too. Yeah. I mean, because he's saying that people are trying to cast Brett Kavanaugh as a serial rapist. Well, that's not the case. The fact of the matter is Christine Blasey Ford is not accusing him, A, of rape. She's saying that it was a sexual assault that would have been tantamount to attempted rape, but that she wasn't raped. And that's one reason, actually, that she said that she put this down and pushed it aside. When it comes to college, the accusations there don't have to do with rape. They have to do with sexual misconduct, the details of which I don't really want to have to discuss on the air. And the accuser, Deborah Ramirez, talks about him pulling his pants up and kind of laughingly, jokingly, kind of going about this. Now, And a lot, and his roommate even at that time said that he certainly was a drinker and that he was belligerent at times when he was drinking. So what Lindsey Graham is trying to create there is a little bit of a straw man. I mean, certainly that's not what people are trying to say about Brett Kavanaugh, but the conduct and the allegations are certainly things that rise to a level that have given a lot of people pause.
And I think the tone that Lindsey Graham took there is something that Republicans were trying to avoid by hiring the outside prosecutor from Arizona to ask the questions for Republicans. But I want to ask you about how Democrats have been handling this hearing. How would you describe how they handled the questioning? Because Senator Cory Booker just had his 5 minutes with Ford. Kamala Harris also did. Both of them got a lot of flack for grandstanding and trying to make it look like they were, you know, trying to posture for the 2020 White House bid.
Prior to this, in the first
Kavanaugh hearing, how are they doing, Democrats?
Well, Harris said that she believes Ford. Booker went on a little bit of an extended riff about what her coming forward means. He called her a hero. There wasn't really like a strong line of questioning from Democrats that was skeptical at all. And there certainly has been no line of questioning from the Republicans at this point, ceding their time to a prosecutor from Arizona, Rachel Mitchell, who a lot of Republicans, by the way, behind the scenes have been criticizing because they feel like she hasn't been able to get to something that can dispute her story, Christine Blasey Ford's story. And in fact, frankly, the format is certainly one that has to be frustrating for Mitchell because she's going 5 minutes along a line of questioning, and then she has to be taken off that line of questioning for an interrupted 5 minutes.
Because then the Democrats get to ask their question.
The Democrat gets to ask the question. Essentially, what happens here is it's a round robin, and if Senator John Cornyn from Texas, for example, decides he wants to ask questions, he could do that, but what every Republican has done so far has ceded their 5 minutes to Ms. Mitchell.
Now, I think Rachel Mitchell has just wrapped up her questioning. So the sense we've had all morning of she's building towards something, there's going to be some kind of thread that she's pulling, and it's going to it apparently didn't happen. Let's listen to just one exchange she had. She asked Ford about a conversation Ford claims that she heard. She heard Brett Kavanaugh and Mark Judge talking after they drunkenly, kind of went down the stairs and she'd escaped to a bathroom. Let's listen.
Now, let me make sure we're on the same page. Were you not able to hear the conversation or not able to understand the conversation?
I couldn't hear the conversation. I was upstairs.
Okay. How do you know there was a conversation?
I'm just assuming since it was a social gathering, people were talking. I don't know.
Okay. In your letter,
I heard them talking as they went down the stairwell. They were laughing. And
Domenico, I just felt like things didn't go anywhere.
Well, there's no closing argument time here where a prosecutor summarize what their point was. And it's not a trial, as you point out. I mean, this is, for all intents and purposes, as even Democrats have said here quite a bit, that this is a job interview. This is about Brett Kavanaugh. But what Mitchell has tried to do in strings that she's been trying to pull is question her recollections, talk about the distance between the party and her home, and if she doesn't remember how she got home or who drove her when Christine Blasey Ford says that it was 20 minutes from that party to her house, how did she get there? No one's come forward. So she's been trying to plant some seeds of doubt in her story. And of course, this was 36 years ago. So of course, there's going to be some haziness in anyone's memory.
And she has acknowledged that.
She has. And she's been very forthright about that, which also a lot of people say lends to her credibility because there are certain things that sexual abuse victims do remember quite clearly, as she mentioned some of those details, and there are other things they certainly don't.
Well, it's interesting that she's a psychology professor. One wonders if that's maybe why she went into the field, because she's been explaining, here's how my mind works.
Using the scientific terms related to the psychology.
Really interesting. Yeah. Hey, we only have a couple minutes, Domenico, and they are wrapping up as well, this portion of the hearing. What do you expect? What will you be listening for with Brett Kavanaugh.
There's a lot of pressure on Brett Kavanaugh right now. He is on majorly thin ice. A lot of Republicans, the White House, are going to be watching this and wondering what kind of case does he make? Because behind the scenes, a lot of Republicans, the president included, were not convinced by his performance. Remember, this president is one who really puts a lot of time and effort into optics, and he doesn't really think that Kavanaugh – it's hard to think that this president thinks that Kavanaugh did a very good job in his Fox News interview. He wasn't forceful, and you know, reports have been that the president watching on a plane, watching Fox News, watching this hearing – believes that Kavanaugh's accuser, Christine Blasey Ford, seems believable.
Well, and Domenico,
there's a lot of pressure on
right.
On,
and briefly,
Kavanaugh
we
here.
Only have a minute here.
Sure.
The president made it clear yesterday that his feelings about Brett Kavanaugh reflect his own feelings about himself. That women have accused him. It's almost as if his reputation. The president seems to feel his reputation is at stake here, not Brett Kavanaugh's.
I think that as somebody who believes that he was wrongly accused by various women, the president, he feels a certain kinship on these kinds of issues and seems to take the side of the person being accused first, especially given the laudatory adult life that Brett Kavanaugh has appeared to have led to this point.
It is a fascinating day in Washington, across the country. Domenico Montanaro, NPR lead politics editor, thanks for watching it with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Later this fall, Arizona will elect a woman to the U.S. Senate for the first time. Republican Congresswoman Martha McSally is up against Democratic Congresswoman Kyrsten Sinema in a race that could determine which party controls the Senate. And polls show the race is a toss-up in a reliably red state. Brett Jaspers joins us for this week's Senate Tracker. He's senior field correspondent at KJZZ. Hi, Brett.
Hi.
Both of these candidates have really fascinating personal stories. McSally was the first female Air Force pilot to fly in combat during the Iraq War, and Sinema was homeless for 3 years as a child before later becoming a criminal defense attorney and then serving in the House. What else can you tell us about these two women?
Well, Martha McSally, she's from the Tucson area, and she, like you said, a trailblazer in the military. She was also the first female commander of a combat aviation unit, so she kind of ascended through the ranks of the military. She also, interestingly, was a legislative fellow for John Kyle, who was Arizona's senator and now, again, is Arizona's senator.
That's
so
right.
She's very kind of connected to Republican politics.
Kyle replaced John McCain after he died.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
And Sinema?
Yeah, she has this very strong story of this, rags to Congress story that she tells. When she was about 8 years old, she was living in an abandoned gas station in Florida with her mother and stepfather and her siblings for about 3 years. So she says on the campaign trail, it's not just bootstraps, but you also need help. Like, both bootstraps and government help can help you succeed, which is what she says is her story. I mean, the details of her struggle have been picked at a little bit by news reports recently. There's a story in the Times that said, court records show that there was electricity in the abandoned gas station, and that's something that she said that they didn't have. But either way, she did have a very poor upbringing for at least a substantial period of her life, and now is, in Congress and could be the first Democrat elected in Arizona in many, many years.
Which would be remarkable.
Statewide.
Yeah, let's listen to a little tape from both campaigns here. We'll start with Martha McSally. This opens up in an aircraft hangar before cutting to a photograph of Sinema standing in a sea of tie-dyes and drums.
Everyone remembers where they were on 9/11. I was deployed to the Middle East, led airstrikes against the Taliban, and was the first woman to fly a fighter jet in combat. I know the price of freedom. While we were in harm's way in uniform, Kyrsten Sinema was protesting us in a pink tutu and denigrating our service. The world is a dangerous place. We need strong...
Okay, so an image there of Kyrsten Sinema in a pink tutu. Does that hurt? I mean, is Sinema really the dove that McSally wants to paint her out to be?
Well, back when the Iraq War was being advocated for and pushed, she was an anti-war protester. That's undeniable. She's been criticized in past political campaigns for this same thing. It's not a new image to people in Arizona. Once she was elected to the state legislature, she earned a reputation for being both progressive and someone who could work across the aisle. Of course, now in Congress, she's much more moderate, one of the most moderate members of the Democratic Party in the House of Representatives. So she's been called a liberal in many past political campaigns and a radical in past political campaigns. It's kind of a question of whether the statewide audience in this campaign is going to find this new or not.
Well, I remember covering Sinema when she first ran for Congress in Arizona. And you're right. A lot of her critics said that she was very liberal. And we've seen her make this change, this shift to the center. A lot of people are saying the same thing about Martha McSally, that she was a Trump critic for a while, and then for the primary, she had to move far to the right. So there is a narrative for both candidates of shifting positions.
Yeah, and McSally, she didn't say whether or not she voted for President Trump, and she criticized him after the Access Hollywood tape, and then during the primary, you know, in order to beat two strong far-right candidates in that primary, she embraced the president and has kind of stayed with it. And that seems to be a strategy that Republicans nationally are doing, because that's the way to win, I think, that they think this year.
Okay, let's listen to some tape from the Kyrsten Sinema campaign. This ad opens up with the sun rising over the mountains.
We have the desert in our blood. Arizonans are strong and independent.
Arizona born. Kyrsten Sinema.
We love our country. We're skeptical of our government.
Kyrsten Sinema, a fiercely independent record.
I'm just not afraid to stand alone to do what's right.
A reputation for working across the aisle.
Forming relationships, identifying common ground, and just getting stuff done.
Independent, just like Arizona.
We heard Kyrsten the word independent Sinema. About Sinema. Three times Kyrsten in Sinema. That ad. How key will those voters be? Because remember, Donald Trump won this state in 2016. But only by something like 4 points. So how important will those independent voters be in this race?
Independent voters are a very large voting bloc in Arizona. There are more people registered as independent than are registered as Democrats, and it's only slightly fewer independents than Republicans. I mean, that block of voters often kind of percentage-wise splits with where the two parties are. But there are, you know, several independent-minded voters that are very wary of the president. And so here's a candidate on the Democratic side who votes with the president about 60% of the time, is positioning herself as a moderate voice. She talks about bread and butter issues like health care, tries to stay away from the more controversial aspects of the national conversation. So her messaging as an independent is clearly what she sees as her path to victory. It's probably a smart move. So it definitely seems like anybody's race at this point.
Brett Jaspers, a senior field correspondent at KJZZ in Phoenix. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Two works now on stage in two different cities are both tackling the stories behind Alzheimer's disease. One is an opera in Philadelphia from the patient's point of view. The other is a play by Oscar-winning filmmaker Kenneth Lonergan that's making its Broadway debut. It tells the story of a family struggling to care for a relative with dementia. Jeff London reports.
Whenever director Joanna Settle told people about her latest project, the opera Sky on Swings, she always got a very personal response.
People everywhere, artists, non-artists, friends, family members of friends, would begin to tell me their stories. I think there was no way for me to talk about what this opera was without hearing personal stories. I haven't met anyone who hasn't been touched by it.
Playwright Kenneth Lonergan has. He wrote the Waverly Gallery in 1999.
The initial impetus was the terrible things that happened to my grandmother and the tremendous, I thought, heroic efforts of everybody else, especially my mother, to help her. It was one of my earlier brushes with the real fundamental curves that life throws at you, and it had a big impact on me, and I just didn't know what to make of it, so I wrote about it.
The goal of both pieces is to provide an empathetic glimpse into the devastating impact of the disease, but they approach the topic from different angles. The Waverly Gallery is told from an outside perspective, how a family copes as its grandmother's memories fail. Sky on Swings attempts to tell the story from the inside, from the perspective of two women in different stages of the disease.
I'll look in the mirror and have no idea who it is. This is happening to me.
Hannah Moscovich wrote the libretto.
So much narrative around Alzheimer's tends to focus on the family members because they're cognizant and also their experience is dramatic and extreme and horrific. And it's just less usual to focus on the experience of the people who are at the interior of Alzheimer's.
What would it be like to form a new relationship as the memories of your old ones are vanishing? Composer Lembit Beecher used music to try to answer that question.
And it seemed in this world where language was starting to fail, but humanity was still burning bright, that music would be an amazing tool to try to explore that world.
In the opera, the two main characters meet in a memory care facility and develop a deep bond.
You're gonna cry again? You a big crier, huh? Oh, I can't find anything!
Opera star Frederica von Stade plays one of them.
I've heard that you form companions and form relationships that may not be what you grew up with. It's not your family, but there's a certain understanding and there's deep sort of affection and appreciation and love that you can find within this terrible situation.
One of the first symptoms of Alzheimer's is memory loss. Kenneth Lonergan wrote the Waverly Gallery from the perspective of a young man remembering his grandmother's struggles with memory. But in an almost unconscious twist, Lonergan says she's not the only one.
There's a lot more about memory in the play than I realized when I was writing it. They're always discussing what happened. Other characters forget things. Other characters repeat themselves. Other characters disagree about what happened in the past, just like any family will.
So in addition to realistic, intense, and sometimes funny scenes with the family, Lonergan wrote a series of monologues delivered to the audience by the character he based on himself, recalling his grandmother's decline.
I stopped going to dinner with her because it got to be too much of an ordeal. She rang my doorbell so much I stopped answering it all the time. Instead, I'd just go to the door and look through the peephole to make sure she was okay. And then I'd watch this weird little convex image of her turn around in the hallway and go back into her apartment.
Both the Waverly Gallery and Sky on Swings, while tracking the progression of this devastating disease, want to illuminate the idea that something remains intact at the core of the people who have it.
The strength of character and the force of a human personality is really formidable. And that's one thing you get out of this. If all you got was misery and death from these illnesses, it wouldn't really be worth writing about. You also get, under this extreme duress, this incredibly heroic everyday behavior.
Lonergan says it's like watching a cathedral that just won't fall down. It's still got beautiful fragments of what it used to be. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Last year's flu season was the deadliest in more than 40 years. New data from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention show 80,000 Americans died of the flu and its complications last winter. Helen Branswell is a public health reporter for Stat News, and she is with us now. Hi, Helen.
Hi, Peter.
80,000 flu deaths. Hasn't been that bad since 1974. Do we know why?
Well, nobody really ever knows why one flu season is really bad and another flu season isn't, except for sort of the basics. Last flu season, most of the activity was caused by H3N2 viruses, which really hit old people and little kids very hard. And another problem with H3 seasons is the vaccine doesn't work as well against H3 viruses. When they make the vaccine, there are some problems, mutations that arise in the development of the vaccine, and they always know that they're going to have a less effective vaccine against H3. When there's not a lot of H3 activity, that doesn't matter so much. But in a season like last year, where virtually everybody who got sick was sick with H3N2 flu, that really does matter a lot.
And about the vaccine, the overall effectiveness of last year's flu vaccine was just 40%. Is that considered a failure? I mean, like, how does that stack up to previous years?
Okay, so the overall effectiveness isn't great, but when you break it down by strain, it was even worse than that. It was 25% effective against H3N2, and as we mentioned before, H3N2 was the virus that was causing most of the illness last year. So what they estimated in February when they released those figures was that essentially, you know, one in four people who were vaccinated were protected against the strain that was causing the most illness. That's not great.
It's not ideal, and it will likely have some people questioning whether or not it's even worth it to go out and get a flu shot this season.
Certainly. People always question whether or not it's worth it. But, you know, the vaccine contains protection against three or four different strains of flu, depending on which vaccine you get. Influenza B causes a lot of illness, especially in little kids, and the vaccine, the influenza B component of the vaccine typically performs better than the H3N2 component and the H1N1 component of the vaccine, which is another influenza A virus. That part of the vaccine also typically performs better. Like last year, the estimate of the performance for the H1N1 component of the vaccine was about 67%, but very few people were infected with H1N1 flu last year, so it didn't matter.
Do the numbers from last year, last season, tell us anything about what this season is going to be like?
No, you know, what people in the flu world will say to you is if you've seen one flu season, you've seen one flu season.
Huh.
Going forward, there's no way to estimate what this flu season would be like. I think people in the flu world would think that because so many people were sick last year, it was a hugely bad year, that there will be a lot of people in the broader population who have some antibodies to flu and that this year might be milder. But, you know, nobody would bet their house on that.
You never know. And these strains change. Helen Branswell, public health reporter for Stat News. We appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
And today we've been following, of course, the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing of Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, the testimony of Christine Blasey Ford, a professor who accused Kavanaugh of sexually assaulting her when they were both in high school. Wrapped up just a little bit ago, Brett Kavanaugh is about to begin his testimony in about 15 minutes. We've looked at this day through a legal prism, a cultural prism. Let's now get the view from two political analysts. Bill Press is the Democrat, host of the Bill Press Show. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Robin.
And Alice Stewart is a Republican strategist. Welcome, as always, to you, Alice, as well.
Thanks, Robin. Great to be here.
Well, is it? You know?
Well, actually, we wish we could be talking about something else,
yeah,
for sure.
I want to start with you, Alice, because there were Republicans coming out of the hearing at a lunch break saying they felt Ford was credible. Not all of them, but enough that it's causing some concern. What position do you think Republicans are in?
A tough one. Without a doubt, because she was credible. And I have said from the moment she came forward that we need to hear from her. She deserves to be heard. And Judge Kavanaugh deserves due process. And we've got a lot to break down in terms of the content of her testimony. But the reality is her credibility is without question. She was certainly not there because she wanted to be there, but it was part of this process. And the fact that she is someone that clearly has suffered serious impact from an emotional disturbing situation that happened to her as a teen. And it will be interesting to see how Judge Kavanaugh responds. I think he needs to show a certain level of force, but also compassion to what she's going through. But at the end of the day, this will boil down to a sincere, credible person with nothing to gain versus a sincere, credible person with everything to lose. And we've got a lot to take into consideration.
Bill Press, again, the Democrat, you can go home now. No, not really. But, you know, there was concern
not
going,
at all.
There was concern going in today that the Democrats might grandstand, might overreach on this, overplay their hand. She is a credible witness. And there was a lot of sympathy expressed for her. But do you think, you know, in previous hearings, some of the Democrats were accused of taking, you know, political advantage of the moment. It was kind of unseemly. How do you think they did today?
I think they behave themselves today. I think, to their credit, they behave themselves today. I think they learned a lesson. But the spotlight was on and should have been on Dr. Christine Ford. We had not seen her. We've never seen her on television or heard from her. And everybody wanted to see, like, who she is and how does she come across. And I do think, echoing kind of what Alice said, that she came across, no doubt, as very sincere, very credible, very real, you know, like most people would be if they're put up on national television and for the first time and in front of a Senate Judiciary Committee for the first time and here taking questions from a prosecutor for the very first time. She started out by saying, I'm terrified. Mm. And I thought everybody right away kind of identified with her. We'd all would be terrified in that position. Even some of us pros who talk for a living, we'd be terrified in that position. But I think it was pretty clear watching her that she did not make this up, that she was not some party puppet, who was just orchestrated for party reasons. And I thought that maybe the most telling thing, Robin and Alice, is when she said that she first stepped up and she first reached out when she saw Brett Kavanaugh's name on a long list of possible people, even before he was nominated, she went to Anna Eshoo's office because she wanted Anna Eshoo to get this to the White House so the White House might know and it might influence their decision.
Eshoo, a lawmaker who got her letter to Dianne Feinstein.
And Christine Ford said it was too bad that she didn't act as soon as she went to the office.
Robin, if I may, I agree with Bill on one of the points that he made is that, yes, the Democrats were very compassionate. They were reserved. They showed extreme deference to the pain or compassion for the pain that Dr. Ford is going through. But I think it is very premature to speculate that Cory Booker will not have another Spartacus moment when Judge Kavanaugh gets up there. I think very strongly that they will take this as an opportunity to make a name for themselves and continue to impugn the character and integrity of Judge Kavanaugh. And I think that will be a huge mistake because it is without question that Judge Kavanaugh is a man that has a long history of professionally, but personally, of a man of integrity and great character. I think going about it that way would be a mistake.
Yeah, I think I agree with Alice. I think it would be a mistake. I'm not sure that they will. Again, I think they learned a lesson the last time, particularly Cory Booker.
When he said, for those who didn't see it, he said, I'm having an I am Spartacus moment. You know, I'm finally going to get to be that character from the films.
Yeah. And I say, Robin, I think someone who did not do so well today and did not help the Republican cause was the prosecutor. I understand, and I mean, I'm not trying to attack her. I just don't think she added anything for the Republicans. I think, if anything, she helped the Democratic side. I know why they did it, but I'm not sure she scored anything for the Republican side. And I think I'm sure that the Republicans, like a Lindsey Graham and an Orrin Hatch and others, were really chomping at the bit to ask the questions that they wanted to
ask. Alice, this is Rachel Mitchell, who's a sex crimes prosecutor. She's kind of sitting in front of the Republican part of the panel is all male. And so they asked for this woman. It was almost like she was their sign language interpreter or something. and yet she didn't seem to we kept thinking that maybe she was building towards a big Perry Mason moment, but there weren't any. She could not poke any holes in Ford's testimony. Is this going to be a mistake, especially when now, in a few minutes, we have Brett Kavanaugh coming out and the Republican males will have found their voices again? They will now be able to, it gives the appearance of, we can speak to men who have been accused of sexual impropriety, but we cannot speak to women who are accusing them. We don't know how to do that.
Well, it's a great point that you raise, Robin, is that I feel like Republicans were darned if they do and darned if they didn't get a woman up there with a more sympathetic tone to question Dr. Ford. The Democrats were screaming for this. And then once they did, they cried that the Republicans were hiding behind a woman and they were afraid and they were cowering. But the reality is, I think Rachel Mitchell, and I've said from the moment she was appointed, would be, in my view, sympathetic toward the victim. That is her role as a sex crimes prosecutor. She has helped victims through these crises for many, many years. And at the end of the day, I feel like her compassionate tone helped the plausibility of Dr. Ford's argument. So it remains to be seen how that will impact the final decision by those on this Senate committee. But as it stands right now, I don't see where she really laid a glove on Dr. Ford. But the senators that are looking at this from a factual standpoint, I don't think any more facts came out than we've already knew. The bottom line is now we have a lot more emotion behind it, and we see a credible victim. But now we're going to hear from, in my view, a credible person who is accused, and it's up to the senators to decide.
One of the things that she got across, Ford got across, again, you know, we have no way of knowing if her version is true, but if anyone thinks that sexual assault is about sex, it was quite obvious it's about violence. And at one point she said Brett Kavanaugh, who was grinding against her, holding her down, put his hand over her mouth, and she thought she was going to be accidentally killed because she couldn't breathe. That's what I think compelled a lot of people to understand what this actually is. But another quick moment was when Kamala Harris said, "You took a polygraph test," and in fact, Ford had said to Rachel Mitchell, "Yeah, I took it because why not? Why shouldn't I take it? I'm telling the truth." Do you think this afternoon someone will say to Brett Kavanaugh, take a polygraph test?
I'm sure that question will be asked. And I think other points that were scored, I thought, and repeatedly, which I think were right on point, is why isn't Mark Judge here? Why
Mark
don't
Judge's
we
friend,
hear
Brett
from
Kavanaugh's
them?
Friend.
Brett Kavanaugh's friend, his drinking buddy, who went to a lot of these parties with him. Mark Judge, who wrote, get this, he was a teenage, heavy drinker as a teenager. He's admitted and wrote two books about his heavy drinking as a teenager. Why wasn't he there?
Well,
and also, why won't they allow the FBI to talk to all of those people who were supposedly at that evening, including Mark Judge? I think the Republicans, it's hard to defend not allowing those two things to happen.
We're going to have to leave it at that. I'm sorry, Alice, but you're expressing concern as well. That was Bill Press, the Democrat, host of the Bill Press Show. Republican strategist Alice Stewart joins us as well. We are going to just keep watching this extraordinary, historic day that we know 6 out of 10 Americans said they were going to sit down and watch, too. Big day. Thank you both.
Thank you, Robin.
Thanks, Robin.
We're going to step away from our top story today, the Senate hearing in Washington, to talk about something admittedly less consequential, Major League Baseball. Teams are heading into the final weekend of the regular season, and in the American League, at least, the playoff teams are essentially set. Boston, Cleveland, and Houston have won their divisions, but there still is a lot of drama to come in the National League. Mike Pesca is Here and Now's sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Hey, Mike.
Hello.
So start with the American League. The Boston Red Sox have a team record with 107 wins. Are they the clear, obvious favorite to win the pennant?
They are not, simply because the nature of baseball doesn't allow. There's a seven-game series in the playoffs as opposed to 162 games over the course of a season. So no team, I think, can really be the clear and overwhelming favorite. I've seen some pretty good odds that actually have them and the Astros as being co-favorites, around 25% chance each to make the World Series. And also, in the specific case of the Red Sox, which are a great team and a great offense, they do have some problems. I'm not sure that their relief pitching is quite so awesome, exactly what you'd want from a playoff team.
And you're going to need that to go deep into these games,
right.
I'd hate to gainsay
a 107 and maybe by the end of the year 110 game winner, but there are some warning signs.
Well, the Astros have more than 100 wins, so you got to go through them, as you said. Cleveland isn't getting quite as much attention, but they're good too.
Yeah, they haven't gotten as much attention for a couple reasons. They just ran away with their division, but they're an 89-win team. And gosh, okay, I'll say the cliche, they're right in the mix. They're right in the mix for the American League.
It's a cliche because it's true. What about the wild card? What are we looking at in the American League and then possibly for the National League too?
Yeah, the American League will be the A's against the Yankees, which could be awesome, especially if one or both of those teams eschew starters, which is a trend. The Rays this year kind of went without starters for many games, and they'd have someone go. I mean, someone has to start the game, but then he gets pulled after two innings. And I could see the A's doing that. In the National League, there is one spot up for bids. It will probably be taken by the Dodgers. But the Cardinals, who were just eliminated by the Brewers in a three-game series, they got swept. The Cardinals are still alive. A pinch-running pitcher fell on the way home in a game last night.
Drama.
And that pretty much, doomed their season.
What about the National League West? I'm a National League West guy. I'm from Arizona. I was very sad to see the Diamondbacks sort of just fade away at the end of the season there. But the Rockies, man, they have come from behind and have leapfrogged the Dodgers, which were always the favorites, especially at the beginning of the year. Everyone said it was going to be the Dodgers.
Yeah. The Rockies have a half-game lead on the Dodgers. They'll be making the playoffs. And the Dodgers were supposed to be, I guess, the Yankees of the West, or maybe the Red Sox of the West, just in terms of payroll and in terms of expectations. And they have underperformed mightily. But this tells you something about the wild card. I mean, you asked about who the wild card was going to be. If you ask yourself, does the wild card help the game? I suppose because the Yankees and Dodgers get to make the playoffs, and they have two of the biggest fan bases. And they're two good teams who we want to see in the playoffs. On the other hand, can you imagine if it really all did come down to the last couple games of the season and the Rockies and the Dodgers really were vying for the one spot in the NL West?
Mm-hmm.
It would be much more dramatic. What baseball has decided to do is trade the drama of one game, a wild card game is very exciting, for a drama of dozens of games throughout the season. And sorry to be curmudgeonly, I don't think it's great for baseball.
You don't like it. All right. Oh,
yeah, well, how I would say I don't like the wild card is I don't like the current format. On the other hand, if there were no wild card, you'd have the Cleveland Indians making the playoffs with 89 wins, and the A's and Yankees have 97 wins. Have I just talked myself off my last position?
Well, next week we'll talk about that. Mm-hmm. Quickly, football, NFL, this is interesting. Hannah Storm and Andrea Kramer just announced they're going to be the first female announcing team when they call tonight's game between the Los Angeles Rams and the Minnesota Vikings. At first blush, that sounds very interesting. Is it a big deal?
I think so. This is on the Amazon broadcast of the game. But I would say this. The best NFL analyst is Doris Burke. She's a woman. In baseball, Jessica Mendoza is on the ESPN Game of the Week. And I would say my assessment of her is she's good. She deserves mm-hmm. to be on a national broadcast, not the best. But the thing with football is the color commentator can be anyone who's good at describing action. But usually the analyst is someone who's played the game. It doesn't have to be. But that's how it is. And because women aren't allowed to play football, there's obviously going to be a gap in the amount of experience that they have. It's unfair to the very qualified Hannah and Andrea, but if we have decided that what we want out of a football announcing team is one play-by-play professional and one former jock, football's very hard because there are no women who have played professional football.
Quickly, Mike, you mentioned it's on Amazon. Very interesting, and I was wondering if people might say, well, this game, they're broadcasting the Amazon Prime game. What does that matter?
Yeah. Well, Amazon gives you another way to watch it because it will be on over the air. But this is a sign of things to come when they rewrite the contracts, when all the leagues negotiate. Just like everything else has cut the cord, there are going to be big Google and Amazon and Facebook are probably going to be making big bids to get professional sports. This is how we're going to watch our sports in the future.
Mike,
maybe with men announcing, maybe with women.
Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.